happening out there, everybody? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and as always, mi amigo. Join me today, Mr. Filio.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in beautiful Skeleton Studios. I'm present. I'm here. I'm a bit saturated. I've been drinking a lot of fizzy water. Yeah, once again, I'm back on the fizzy water. I think when the summer gets here, it's not quite summer yet, but close enough, as we approach the, the summer equinox that's coming up, the longest day of the year, I slip back into big fizzy time.
I tell you what I've gotten into. They're the Crystal Light packages.
Mm-hmm.
But because where it all started was whenever we like to keep them with us whenever we go hiking or anything, so you can throw them in your Nalgene.
Yeah.
These have caffeine in them. Woo, man. You talk about getting that caffeine buzz. You got to be careful on those things. Of course, I don't drink a lot of caffeine anyway, aside from coffee. So you get spun off on those things quick.
I'm pretty hyper as it is, so I don't ever drink like 5 hour energy or anything like that. I have about 2 cups of coffee in the morning. I'm usually pretty good. Now, long ago, back when I was playing like hockey and softball and stuff, I would every once in a while grab one of those monster energy drinks.
When you were chasing skirts.
But man, I'm telling you, like, you better have some activities planned, because I would be like
some activities
bouncing off the walls. Yeah.
Some activities, he
says.
But
I don't drink that anymore. I can't believe people do, too, because I've heard a lot of people that got like kidney stones.
That's what gave me mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I got them from. That's what the doctor narrowed it down to.
Yeah.
It was not awesome. Folks, we have a really fun show for you today. I'm going to dig into some crazy tales of help beyond the grave. But before we dive into that, Kyle has popped another one here on me that I cannot wait to hear. I believe it's everybody's favorite man of the woods, the Glimmer Man.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the Glimmer Man. There's still more sightings being sent into the show. And this one was forwarded to us from a website called Hernando's Hideaway. It's pretty cool. It says the following might be a sighting of a cloaked Bigfoot or Sasquatch, as the witness thinks it is. It says, even as a child, I loved to walk and explore the forest that surrounded my home. I was probably around 7 or 8 when this happened. I really don't remember exactly. But anyway, one day I went for a walk in the woods and came to a log in a very peaceful setting. I made this spot my regular place to go when I felt a need to be by myself. I would sit on the log and listen to the sounds in the woods and just feel the peace and calm of the place. I'd gone to this spot many times before by myself after my discovery and never felt frightened. I suppose I was meditating even at that young age, but I didn't know anything about what it was called at that young age. Yeah, people back then actually allowed their kids to wander off by themselves in the woods. I miss those days. This particular day, as I sat on the log, I heard some rustling in the bushes. I felt an uneasiness come over me, as if, Cam, I was being watched.
Uh-oh.
I could sense the direction it was coming from, too. So, I stood up and walked slowly to get a better view when I noticed a very large creature that I could see through standing between two trees. I would say it was at least 8 feet tall, maybe even more. Now, the body of the creature had a wavy pattern flowing through it, like heat waves that come up from a hot road. I could see the forest behind it and through it. The wavy pattern is how I was able to make out its form. There wasn't anything causing a heat wave anywhere else. It just stood there looking at me. I froze for a moment in pure fear that encompassed my entire being. But out of pure fight or flight adrenaline, I finally made my legs move and I walked a safe distance. Then I ran. I was afraid if I started running, it would chase me, like they say animals will do. I made it safely back home, and I don't remember ever going back into those woods alone after that. I actually missed going to my spot. It was my place to find peace and talk with nature. That thing stole it from me. Since that encounter, I've often wondered if this is how Bigfoot is so good at avoiding capture. I've read where others say they think it has the power to become invisible. Perhaps they're right. It looked like a Bigfoot to me, only invisible. I at some point later realized that other witnesses have seen what they call the Glimmer Man. Maybe that's what I saw. So that's pretty cool.
Word.
So see, this is another one. They don't really talk about what year it took place. They talk about they were young, 7 or 8.
Yeah.
and they saw, you know, what they thought was a Bigfoot or something. But once again, like heat waves, I understand that description, right? It's cloaking itself. It's like in the movie Predator.
I love it.
I wonder what are the people seeing? Like, I really want to know, what are they seeing?
Well, that's something like we've talked about. You can't misidentify a bear for a glimmer man. You can't misidentify anything walking on its back legs for a glimmer man, because we don't have anything that can go invisible.
Right. And the descriptions also change. Some people say it's giant in size, but most people say it's typical human size, you know, like a typical average sized man, which is like 5'10", 5'9". There are some descriptions of it being thin or, you know, super tall, but most of the time it's just human shaped. But it's strange. I wonder if this has been going on all along, or is it something new that's happening now? I don't know. But it does appear that there's more and more people at least coming forward with their sighting. In fact, there's a couple different websites now. If you just search up Glimmer Man sightings, you can find several
other
websites that are now relaying these stories. So, and if you go on Reddit, there's a lot of stuff being shared there on Reddit. A lot of it is our stuff. But I'm glad that people are sharing it.
And I'm glad it's finally coming out. Yeah, more people are talking about it.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
Because it's like we've always said before, you have people that have these strange and different sightings. And even in the world of crazy sightings, they don't come forward. Because like we've always joked, you don't want the UFO people to think you believe in Bigfoot, because you don't want them to think I'm crazy. You know, you don't.
I understand what you're saying.
There's always that judgment in these circles. And you're just like, hey, look. If somebody saw one thing, let's talk about all of it. Maybe we can piece it. Always think about all the work Joshua Cutchin does. Let's just piece it back together. Let's see what we can do with all of these threads out, what we can catch.
I think younger people, because of social media and all that stuff, are much more likely to share an experience, where the older generation, ours and even older, they probably don't even know how to share or just disregard it. I mean, how many times you see something weird and you're like, oh, I wonder what that is. And then you just go about your day and you just never really think about it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like months later, you'll see like a news ad and it'll come on and they'll tell you, oh yeah, they're building this super collider. You're like, oh, I saw that. I was wondering what that was.
Yeah.
Same. That's the way I think about it. Somebody probably had the sighting, totally forgot about it. And then they see a glimmer man starting. They're like, oh, I remember I saw that.
Yep. You get busy with life.
Well, and what are you supposed to do cruising with it? If you're like, if you're bebopping around 1980, there was no like massive internet. Yeah. What are you supposed to do? Share it with your friends? Like you said, a lot of people don't want to share it.
Yeah.
People feel comfortable sharing it in podcast or websites like ours and stuff, because they know that people that are listening and following this stuff are into the paranormal. They're not as likely to be judged.
Well, they're also, everyone's disconnected. Everyone hearing this, we don't see anybody. It's just you and I in this room. There's nobody else here. So we're disconnected from the audience. The audience is disconnected from us, individually disconnected. So when you send a story in, you have that safety of disconnect. Like you could even create a fake email to keep yourself if you wanted that feeling. And I'm telling people now, if you are have any reservations about sending stories, not just to us, but to any podcast, and you feel, build a fake email, do whatever you take that would make you feel comfortable to send it. But whatever you do, email that story in, write that story down to the best of your ability and send it in. It needs to be documented somewhere. People just need to get it out there.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with creating an alternate email and not fake, but maybe just like a pseudonym.
Yeah, if it's easy, right? If it makes you feel better, if you don't feel like sharing that information or you're afraid it may get back to you, do something along those lines. Would be a lot easier.
I agree.
Here's something that you're going to love. This comes from LB. LB sent this in, and then now Lon's got it. Lon's got it too. Tall, pale humanoid approaches shocked camper at Ovens National Park in Nova Scotia.
LB? All I can think of is the Hateful Eight. Yeah. OB, remember?
OB. And they kill OB.
Yeah.
This is what it goes on to say. Before this incident, I had never had a paranormal experience in my life. That being said, my boyfriend seems to have enough for the both of us. We went camping in the early fall of 2016 at Ovens National Park, Nova Scotia. We had just arrived back from spending the summer in Western Canada and hadn't seen each other in 4 months. So we decided to spend some time together and go camping with another couple that we were close friends of ours. And we booked the cheapest cabin at the campground for 2 nights and headed out. The first day we spent there was pretty uneventful. To give some context, the park is famous for its sea caves that are carved into the rocky cliffs of the Nova Scotian East Shore. Well, the first day we hiked the trail that overlooked the caves, so this is for the ovens, as they were called, and we were able to go down into some of them. And that night we had a campfire, but turned in early. So we sat inside the small cabin and started playing cards. My boyfriend was being a sore loser and seemed to be acting kind of strange, so he abruptly said he was going for a walk and left the cabin. I was pretty annoyed and just let him go for a while and didn't chase him. After about an hour, I started to get a bit anxious and called his cell phone. This is where things start getting really weird. He didn't answer at first, but he called me back, of course, right away. And when I answered, he seemed to have calmed down a bit, and I asked him where he was. He said he was sitting on a bench on the trail. Then he asked where I was. This confused me a bit because I hadn't left the cabin since he left, and it wasn't likely, you know, since I'm terrified of the dark. I told him this, and this suddenly freaked him out. He said he was coming back to the cabin. It was weird because he's generally pretty level-headed and hard to actually scare. So, after about 2 or 3 minutes, I heard running footsteps, and they're coming towards the cabin, and my boyfriend comes tearing through the door. Then this is what he told me. He had walked out to the trails to get some fresh air and sat down on one of the benches to look out at the ocean. The moon was pretty bright that night, so everything was illuminated very well. Then he said he heard someone walking by, and he saw this really tall, pale figure stop and look at him, and then continue on. For some reason, he assumed this was me coming to look for him, and that's when I called him and told him I was in the cabin. He said that in retrospect, the figure was inhumanly tall and pale and couldn't possibly be a person. Now, my boyfriend was not himself for the rest of the night and didn't seem normal until about lunch the next day. Does anyone have any idea what this was or could have possibly been? LB. LB, that is a hell of a story.
Right.
And, yeah, you might want to look along the lines of the rakes. You might want to look along the lines of, like, the military when we always bring up of something. Anything tall, pale, humanoid, my mind goes to rake.
Yeah, I've even seen video footage and stills caught by, like, trail cameras of odd-looking, like, pale-looking humanoids.
Things, I mean, you know. Slightly disturbing.
Yeah, some of them are real thin.
Yeah.
Emaciated, some are tall.
Yep.
They're also, if you want to search up, like, Gollum sightings, I mean, it's very similar to a lot of those.
Yes.
People are talking about the Gollum sightings, but I kind of think that they're all the same thing. Now, what that is, I haven't the slightest idea.
Evil.
It's scary. That's what I know.
Very scary. Folks, let's take a quick break. When we jump back on the other side, I'm going to be digging into about 3 ghost stories of helping hands from the grave. I think y'all are going to enjoy it. Let's take a quick break and check it out. You're listening to Expanded Perspective. All right, y'all. As I alluded to, I think this is going to be something that's entertaining, but, man, I like to believe this is a thing. I like to believe in a lot of things, but whether they're real or not, I would like to believe them. I would like to believe that this is a thing, that if you had unfinished business, we know that the ghosts can stay behind because they have unfinished business. But I like to believe that if you had unfinished business and you knew something that could help someone, that you would be able to stay and maybe complete it. Maybe not like a cursed thing, you know, like we're not talking about like where you're forced to relive it, but more along those lines of where it's something that you would feel drawn to do, your spirit, your soul would feel drawn to do before you could transition to the next plane. So that's kind of what jumped out at me about these things is my daughter and I were having a conversation about something along this line. And that's whenever I was like, you know what? I need to look more into this. I need to see if this is a thing and there's more to it. I'd remembered a case and I think we've discussed it, but I'm going to go over it again with you real quick and kind of give you a refresher before I get into the other couple of cases that I have. But the one that most people, if you're if you're privy to this sort of wild stuff and these are the things that you're into and you like these tales, this story that I'm about to go over is kind of like the story of Patterson Gimlin in some of the ghost communities. And it is the tale of Miss Zona Hester. Now, she has a much longer name than that. I don't know why it was back in the day. People felt the need to pile on other names. But so she'd kept her maiden name, I believe, and anyway took her husband's name, but never gave up the maiden name. So she had basically had two middle names. But her name was Elva Zona Hester Shue. She's from Lewisburg, West Virginia. Now, this took place back in 1897. So we have to roll the dial back a ways in the Wayback Machine to hop in there and go back to check this part out. Now, you can imagine life in 1897. Basically, it was what your husband said was law. That's the way things were. No talking back. A woman could and most often did get smacked, get hit if she talked back. She had no opinions that if she, well, she had opinions, but she wasn't allowed to voice them. They were a lot of things. Yeah, they were making some changes, but it was still a man's world, if you will. It was still, that's the way things were. So when people believed in a family that things were going well, they turned to the husband. The husband said, yep, you know, this is how things are. This is the way it is. This is all this. So if something was to happen to your wife, you would naturally believe the husband. The husband is the, at the time, was the breadwinner. He was the big boss. And that's the way it went. And as we all know, that's not the best thing. People today lie. People back then really lied. And if you had carte blanche to just lie all you wanted, well, then there you go. You can kind of understand where these things are going and where this woman's name and background ties in with a ghost. Yeah. So on January 23rd of 1897, Zona had only been married for three and a half months at this time. And there at her house, they had found her deceased at the bottom of the stairs, conveniently splayed out as if she had fallen down the stairs. So the story goes on like this. Her husband's name was Edward. Edward was a blacksmith, and Edward worked there in the town. And from what I understand, was a good blacksmith. Very good blacksmith. You know, things that you can read, things you can find. You know, there was people made comments. Fella knew what he was up to, you know, knew what he was doing. Which, if you're going to have a blacksmith, that's what you want. You know, you don't need a green blacksmith. You know, you need a fella that can get down to it. And he was older, of course, than Zona, Miss Elva. The name Zona is awesome. Zona, that's a cool name. So he was older than her. And had a nice place, you know, had a nice house there. Log cabin, actually a log cabin, two-story. Of course, that's the reason he's at the bottom of the stairs. And it's not like it's a two-stair bi-level and she fell. Although it might be. That'd have been even a better one. So what's really wild about this whole thing is what they said she had died of. So you wonder how she was found. The husband was at work. Edward was actually at work during all of this stuff. Who found him was a young boy, 11-year-old boy, that found Miss Hester. And what he had done, his name, I believe, was Andy. And Andy did odd jobs, right, around the Hester house. He would go around and take care of stuff, things like that, while the husband was at work. And Andy found Miss Hester's body at the base of the stairs. And, of course, he ran straight to his house, told his mama, I can't believe it, you know, and all this stuff. Mama's like, hey, look, we got to go get the doctor. They went to get the doctor. They get back to her. And, you know, the doctor checks everything out, you know, and he's like, oh, go get the husband. So they go get the husband. All this stuff goes down, right? So by the time the doctor actually showed up, the husband's there. So word travels fast, small town. So the husband's there. He's holding his wife in her arms and he's crying. Just, I mean, unconsolably sobbing about this whole thing. He can't believe what had happened, you know, and he's holding her and got her head and shoulders in his arms, in his lap, sitting there. And he won't really let anybody around her. So the doctor, you know, does what he can and says, hey, look, she died of an everlasting faint. Now, I don't know about y'all, but that is a hell of a name for a death. Everlasting faint. Makes you think of the everlasting gobstopper. But the everlasting faint is what took Mrs. Zona's life. Basically, a heart attack. It's what we know today as the heart attack. So they take it, the body. When I say they take Miss Shu, Mrs. Ono, they take her and they go get her ready for burial. But the husband back then, you have to understand too, because I didn't really gather this and I need to talk to my cousin. My cousin is a funeral director and has been a funeral director slash mortician for ever since. I mean, he graduated high school, went to school for that. And that's what he's done. And he is in his 50s now. So he's done it forever, for as long as I can remember. But he's one of those guys that knows the history, right? I mean, he is big into the history of all of this. And he has a lot of collectibles, if you will, in his, you know, line of work. He has a lot of these collectibles. But anyway, so I need to talk to him about all this stuff. But apparently it was a common thing for the family to be intimately involved with the preparation of the body prior to the funeral. So, there, you know, there was a, not really a funeral home. You know, they always had the, you know, the casket maker right there, like the mortician. You know, he built caskets and kind of stored people like cordwood till they were buried. So they really wasn't, you know, a full-blown thing. Not in every town. Now, yeah, they may have been in that year, of course, but not in every town. You're probably not going to find them. So they were intimately involved with the preparation of her body before burial. And the husband, Edward, made sure that he was there every step of the way. Not just every step of the way. He placed her in the casket. He was the man that always took care of the head. He made sure her head was turned the right way. He folded up sheets and wedged them around her head to kind of keep it secure, to keep it from turning one way or the other. And his lie was he wanted a soft pillow for her to lay her head on. He wants to make sure that she has a nice nap, you know. So, but then here's a really odd thing. Then he starts crying and he was like, this is, he pulls out of his pocket a scarf, a very nice scarf for the time. And he's crying. And he said, this was Zona's favorite scarf. She loved to wear it. A little bit of info. People that were questioned don't recall her ever wearing a scarf like that. They don't even know where it came from. So he ties it around her neck. This is everything. Everything's ready, right? So he does it, ties it around her neck. He's got her put in there. Then the body is taken to a nearby town where her mother, Miss Mary Hester, lives. And so they open the casket to do the wake. Edward never leaves the head end of the casket. He stays there all day and all night, not letting anybody around her head. And then that's it. It's done. The wake's over. They sealed it up. They carried her out and they buried her. The way things go. So there were odd behavior, of course, coming from Edward. This whole thing kind of seemed odd. Why would she be at the bottom of the stairs from a heart attack? Wouldn't you die at the top? Going down should be easier. Going up's where the work was, you would think. If you tripped and fell, you would be looking for broken bones. It wouldn't have been a heart attack. But then again, he wouldn't allow the doctor to completely, you know, examine her. So this is what we have. Well, within the month of her death, within the 30 days of that, her mother, Mary, sitting down having tea with a few of the neighbors, and still, of course, in mourning, you know, really missing her daughter, missing the times that they'd shared together like, you know, any mother would. She starts telling a few of her friends there in her little circle of tea that she had a dream about Zona. And not just one dream, but it's happened four nights in a row. And she said, every time in my dream, Zona appears to me. And she starts telling me that her husband, Edward, killed her. He is the one that broke her neck. And she keeps telling her mother and reiterating over and over and over the words, tell on him, tell on him. And that's all she can remember from the dream. And it's very, very disturbing. Now, Mary knows that her daughter wasn't in the best of relationships. In fact, she didn't really want her to marry him, because he was a very abusive and cold-hearted man. And said that when things weren't right, he would let you know about it. He would really, you know, and that he kind of treated Zona more as a possession, like we discussed at the start of the show, than his wife. So Mary starts like, you know, something's got to be done. I keep having this stuff and I don't know what's going on. And I don't really know what to think. And then one night, Zona comes to her again as this keeps piling up. And Zona shows her, and I guess in a way of more like a show and tell as it is to talk, lets her see what had happened anyway. And it could have easily been Mary's imagination, of course, but that she was attacked by her husband and her husband killed her. So that was it. That was it. It was done. So this is what goes down. Mary's like, that's it. We're going to tell somebody. We have to go talk to somebody about this dream that I keep having. Now, if that was to happen today, you can only imagine how well received it would be. Very, very little. People would laugh at you. People would tell you to get out of their office. And back then, I don't know that it was really any different, but people were a little more open to it. So they go real in the town, and it didn't take long, mind you, after those few days of the gossip circle that she sat around and had tea with, that they told their friends might have mentioned it to their husbands. And the next thing you know, over half the town is already hearing about, hey, did you hear Zona's coming back in dreams, right? Goes on. So Mary goes and gets her brother-in-law, and her brother-in-law, he escorts her down to a prosecutor, the Lewisburg prosecutor there, a Mr. John A. Preston. And he didn't believe it. He's telling the story. He's like, no, I don't believe any of that. He thinks that she's making it all up just to try to get some closure because she had a problem with Edward. So he starts questioning Mary, and that goes on for quite some time, several hours, actually, quite some time. And then he pops out and he's like, hey, you know what? After all of this stuff, I believe you. I had time. I didn't believe it when you sat down and told me, but now I'm believing what you're saying. What you're telling me. And so she's ecstatic. I'm like, oh yeah, you know, it's here we go. We're moving forward. What can we do? So they start looking around. They're like, what can we do? So they're like, let's go to the doctor. So they go to Dr. Knapp, the man that diagnosed her, and says, hey, could this be a thing? Could this have happened? This is what's going on. Could this have actually happened? And he's like, well, yeah. I mean, I guess I didn't really get to examine her the way I wanted. And I mean, I thought it was very odd of him. So this goes on. I was like, let's look into this fella. Like, let's look into Edward. Well, come to find out, his name's not Edward. His name is Erasmus Stribling Trout Shoe. Remember I told him about all those names? If Erasmus isn't bad enough, sorry for everybody out there that's named Erasmus, if any of y'all are listening. Erasmus is a rough name to have, right? Maybe not then, but now. I'm going off now's time. Then you have a name of Stribling. Stribling. I'm going to change my name to Stribling. Not Cameron Stribling. Just Stribling is my name. But it was Erasmus Stribling, then the name Trout Shoe. Yeah. Now, apparently, he had gone by the name of Trout his whole life. Everyone knew him as Trout. Not a bad name. Awesome. Cool name. But when the doctor goes to looking in, Dr. Knapp and him go to looking into who he really is, they find out that Trout Shoe had a really shady, is a light term, background. He'd been in the penitentiary, and he'd been married twice before Mary and Zona, and both of those wives had died under very strange circumstances as well. One of them allegedly died from a broken neck. There's the heart attack. the everlasting faint. The everlasting broken neck is what she died from. Apparently, she had fallen off some hay bales. They were stacking hay in the barn. She's out there right along with her, helping her husband. Fell off the hay. Broke her neck. The other one, get a load of this. The other one died, allegedly, while Trout was repairing his chimney. He had a basket of stones, like the Round River stones. He's building his chimney, and the basket flipped, and the wife was the one pulling the basket up. Had the rope attached to it, to like a block and tackle, raising it up. Really odd, right? Why would the wife be doing it? He's stronger. You can't pull it up and tie it all. I mean, anyway. So The basket flips upside down. One of the rocks falls, hits his wife at the time on the head, killing her. Or because you don't have the first 48, did he take a river rock and bash her head in? More than likely, that's a yes. So when they found that information, they exhumed her. They dug in. They took her out. Now, here's another thing. Edward, or Trout, threw a wall-eyed fit, right? Like, had a big old hissy fit breakdown over this whole thing. Said, you cannot exhume her. You cannot take her out. You cannot do this. She will never rest. You have to leave her. And everybody like, look, dude, if there ain't nothing wrong, you don't have anything to worry about. If she's good, you're good. But you know how that goes. Murderers don't dig on that. They don't like all that stuff, right? So, he actually says, before they start, they got everything going, they're getting ready to start digging up, and he actually says this, that if he was going to be arrested, he goes, but they will not be able to prove it. That's all he said. Go ahead and dig her up, but you won't be able to prove it. Why would you say that? Why would you say that without it just blasting? Because right then it tells you. He knows he killed her. He 100% knows he killed her. And on March 9th, a report came out that and this is what it says. It's from the newspaper called the Independent. And they actually reported that not only was her neck broken, but that her windpipe had been crushed. And that there were marks on her throat where the fingers had been wrapped around her neck. And that the neck was dislocated between the top or the first and second vertebrae. And now I don't know about this, but the windpipe had of course been crushed in, like the thumbs had been right on her windpipe and crushed it in like a small area. Like it's not, you know, the whole neck where the thumbs had been. And they said the ligaments were torn. So not only did he choke her and crush her windpipe, but he wrenched her head back and forth, breaking the vertebrae. He did everything he could do in the most violent manner to end her life and try to cover it up. And he succeeded for about 28 days. And then it all came out. So the minute they find all this out, well, what do? They charge him with murder, right? They bring him in, bring the whole deal in. So he ends up, of course, being convicted of murder, and they were going to hang him. And what's really wild is that when Mary took the stand, she was asked about this information. And she said, my daughter came to me and gave me the information. And one of the prosecutors, or the defendants rather, said, the defense attorney said, so we're going to believe, you know, a ghost. And she was like, I don't see any other way, because she's the one that led us to the proof. So without that, now it could, you like you could say, we could easily sit here and say, hey, look, it's a mother's intuition, right? And it could be. You women beat all I've ever seen when it comes to knowing your children. And I can't imagine, I mean, I love my kids, but I don't have that kind of connection that my wife has with them. And I'm sure when you carry something inside of you and for that many months and you give this being life, there's going to be a connection there. And obviously there is. So for all we know, it was Mary going off her gut feeling that something had happened to Zona, and knowing how Mary's or Zona's husband was, or like I told you, I like to believe that it was actually a ghost come to Mary. It was Zona came to Mary, told her, hey, look, get this dude. Now the best part about it is that, they were going to hang him a few days later and they stopped that. Like I'm talking like a mob came, you know how that stuff goes, and they were going to hang the old boy, and they didn't, they kept him, and they ended up sending him to Moundsville, and that's where he went to the state prison. But he only died a couple of years later. Like he didn't stay too long, because of course you can only imagine back then, prison's probably not the most awesome place to be, right? Like back then, especially, I'm sure they didn't feed you real well when you were in the prison back there. So I wanted to know, well, is there other ghosts? Like I said, let's start at this. Was there other ghosts that may have interacted with some people? And sure enough, there is. There is the story of a ghost in South Carolina. Now, what's funny is there's going to be a couple of Carolinas in here, but the South Carolina ghost that I want to talk about comes from a little town along the East Coast called Pawleys Island. And if you look at the photographs, Pawleys Island looks pretty awesome. It's a place I'd like to actually go visit. It looks historic. Now, you have to imagine, too, it's kind of swampy around that area. You know, it's got some marshes, if you will. But the beaches look awesome, and I'm not even a beach kind of guy, but it does look like a really cool spot. And in this little town, there is a story of the Gray Man. So the Gray Man, here's the story behind Gray Man. If I can remember how this whole thing goes, you've caught me not paying attention, folks, and I don't have it right here in front of me, but I can try to remember as best I read. The story of the Gray Man goes like this. Now, there's a bunch of others. Like, there's a bunch of stories people have, local lore, places around it. There's a bunch online, man. You can get on and look all kinds of stories on the Gray Man. But from what I can tell it, let's just tell it this way. Let's say this is one of many. And one of many of this legend is the fact that a young woman is missing her love, if you will. Her love is a sailor. And he has money. You know, he's a trader and runs spices, whatever it is. So the story goes that this fella a long, long time ago, that this fella had been at sea and he was so eager to come back and see this girl. And this girl actually ended up or becoming his fiance. So he comes back and he sees her. And of course, like we say, the absence makes the heart grow fonder. And they spend every waking minute that they have together. He's got money. She comes from a well-to-do family. It is, her parents believe, a match made in heaven. It's just the way it is. And so he's constantly, you know, but he's working, he's hustling, he's grinding. He's, you know, this is what he does. So he goes back out, you know, he's back out on the sea sailing, and she misses him dearly. And she knows this time when he comes back, we're going to get married. You know, I'm the fiance to this fella. You know, he's carving out his niche. This is perfect. So he's due back, and she's all excited right there. She cannot wait. She's all excited that he's coming back, and he makes it back, and he makes it back. And him and one of his buddies, you know, that he has, one of his, like, his right-hand man that helps him on the ships and all the trading and all this stuff, they jump on their horses, and they're going to head. He's going to ride with him, and they're going to go over there and see his girl. He can't wait. You know, I mean, this is what he's working for, to start his family. And they decide to take a shortcut. You know how the shortcuts go. They never go great. So he's like, I'm going to cut across this way through these marshy areas, and we're going to, you know, I know where the house is. We're going to be right there to it. So the two dudes, boom, take across over their horseback. And what ends up happening is something that I think all of us around my age, and even a little older, I would say between at the ages of 40 and 50, you remember this. Of course, older, you'll remember it, but, you know, all the way down to right here, about 40, 45. In fact, I'll be 45 this year. So yeah, so right around in that time, you're going to remember this was a big deal. And what I'm talking about is quicksand. Quicksand was way more dangerous in my mind than it turned out to be in the real. Like, I thought it was going to be a real problem growing up. And as a kid, turns out it's not. But so this story goes, quicksand's a problem. The story goes that the young fella is in such a hurry to get to see his fiance, he's riding ahead of his friend, that he rides off into a marsh full of quicksand, he and the horse. And of course the horse is struggling. He's struggling. His buddy can't get him out. He's looking, he don't have any rope. He don't have anything. So he sits there and watches his friend and his friend's horse go out of sight and die in this quicksand. So then he has to ride and he has to go tell his fiance, we just got here. I know you're waiting here. You got to help me. He's in the quicksand. He's dead. They get a group together, and you know how this goes. They find him, the whole thing. So, yes, he died in the quicksand. And, of course, they have the funeral, and she is inconsolable also. She's done. She's living with her mom and dad, and she's just a wreck. I mean, she can't go on, and it's a terrible, terrible tragedy. And so she takes up to walking on the beach down in front of her mother and father's home, because that's where her and her lover always took their walks. And you can imagine, insert romantic picture in your mind right here of what it was like. And so one day, it's windy, you know, you can, it's kind of overcast, and she's okay with it because, of course, she is bummed completely out, still mourning. It doesn't really tell you how long this was after all these things, but she here's the ocean, here's the wind, and she looks up, and up ahead of her, there's somebody else on the beach. And instantly she gets this chill down her back because she can tell at that distance and how this figure's moving and how it's walking and that's her fiance. And as she gets clear and clear look at this figure as they get closer, it's her fiance, 100%. And he walks right to her and she walks right to him and he looks right at her. He says, you must leave this island at once. You are in danger. You must leave. And she says, then the figure vanishes right in front of me. And it's not like a thought. It's not like a mirage. It was a figure, my fiance, telling me this in broad daylight. So she sits there, whichever. She's out of her mind, right? She can't believe that just happened to her. So what is she going to do? She books it back to her mom and dad's house, tells her mom and dad, this is what happened. I know it was him. They know who his family is. They know, everything, the whole deal. And they take it serious. Crazy enough, they take it serious and they actually have a home inland up in. So what do? Well, they load up the next morning. They spend all night getting all their stuff gathered up, get it all loaded up in their wagons, and they head inland. Now, it doesn't say how far they go inland. But what it does say is after they had left and this whole thing, they weren't aware till they came back after they had heard. But when they got to their inland home and unpacked, a hurricane hits Pauli Island and destroys most of all the houses except her home. Their home that she was living in is basically undamaged. There's nothing that happened to it. It's just clean as a pin. And so that's where the story starts of the gray man. And it has gone on and gone on for some believe over 200 years of the gray man appearing to people and letting you know that there's fixing to be a big storm. There's a hurricane. There are accounts before every major hurricane that's ever hit that island of gray man sightings, interaction somewhere, whether he talks to them. I don't think he talks to them anymore. I can't. Man, he might. But, just being involved in this whole thing, the gray man is always there. It's kind of like the Mothman, except we got gray man, except this is just a dude, like we said, just like a gray sailing outfit is all he's wearing. So the most, I guess you could say one of the most popular stories comes from a man and wife, Jim and Clara. Their last name is Moore. And they were there during Hurricane Hugo. I believe Hurricane Hugo was 89. I should have probably looked that up. But anyhow, so 89, Hurricane Hugo rather. They were there. They knew, of course, they're like, yeah, Hurricane Hugo. Yeah. They said it's a couple of days before that. They always go walking in the afternoon. They like to eat their dinner and then they like to go for a stroll. And so they go walk. So Jim was interviewed and he says, you see a lot of people, of course, walking on the beach at that time of day. And he said, but this afternoon that they chose to go, they didn't see anybody. There was actually nobody on the beach. With Jim said, man, he goes, that's kind of odd. I expected to see a few. And so they're kicking down through there and there's only one. They notice one person walking. And Jim says that as they get closer and closer, they said that the guy kind of looks old school, right? Like this, this is kind of weird. And Jim and Clara said, as they're getting closer, Jim raises his hand to say, hey, what's going on? How's everything? And he says, as he raises his hand goes to speak, the vision disappears in front of both of them. They both saw it. Gone. They said another strange thing. There was no tracks in the sand. You could see it walk all the way to them. They didn't realize there's no tracks. How often do you think about looking at tracks when you're thinking about being cordial and being nice to someone as they're approaching? Probably not that often. And he vanishes. So 2 days later, Hurricane Hugo hits, destroys the neighborhood that Jim and Clara live in, smashes it, except for their home. Again, basically undamaged. A few little things, but not much, right? Not much going on. There's another story of a fisherman that was fishing in a place called Merle's Inlet, and it's like 10 miles from the island there. Now, what's wild is there's a lot of this story that'll go on. It usually always takes there, but a few people have seen him out and around, the gray man and out and around. And anyway, he tells the story that he had been out boating all day. I'm sure fishing is what the fellow was doing. You know, he's a fisherman, you know, so he's been out working all day. It's getting dark. He's headed back in and he decided, you know what? I think I'm going to make one more pass and I'm going to try to find some oysters. That's what I'm going to do. And he says he looks up just out of the blue, you know, just kind of, huh, and looks back towards the beach. And he sees a figure on the beach waving. So he was like, I think he's motioning to, maybe he's in trouble. So he gets his boat and he runs down there and he gets close to the beach and he realizes the figure's not waving at him. The figure has got his hand up telling him to stop, you know, like not to drive, like don't go anywhere. Like I'm picturing double hands, right? Stop what you're doing. And he can't figure out what it was. He's like, what's he going on? He says that this figure looked like an old pirate, like pirate clothing, but gray. He said, I don't know what's going on. He said, I'm looking at him and looking at him. And I'm like, what? And he said, I looked down for just a second. I looked down, rubbed my eyes. Like, what is that? And he said, I looked back up and he's gone. And he goes, right then, I'm like, something is not awesome. He's like, that's it. I've too much sun, too many, you know, Bud Lights. I don't know what it is, right? You know, have no idea. I'm going in. So he goes back in, he docks it, puts all of his stuff up, gets his gear, goes back home. A few hours later, a freak storm hits, smashes in a bunch of the inlet there. Heavy winds, monster rain. I mean, it's just basically Mother Nature kicking tail, right? But he wasn't on the water. He said if he would have gone and made the last run that he had planned on running, well, then more than likely he would have been stuck on the water. So there's a few tales of wackiness that comes from the gray man, but he's not the only one. Here is one. Now, this is one because it has so many tales. This feels like tales and threads, sorry, so many threads that this feels like it should be a movie, would make a great movie. Or even if you just took this premise, maybe not this exact story, but took this premise and turned it into a movie, it would be awesome. It'd be unbelievable. So we're going to jump back. Again, we got to go back in time, right? So we got to go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s. And I'd say probably again, like in the mid 1880s, there was a fella named James L. Chaffin. Now, Mr. Chaffin lived in Mocksville, North Carolina. And he lived there his whole life. This fella was a farmer and he owned some land there. And was just a hard-working country fella. That's what he did. Took pride in what he did, was good at what he did. So that's what he did. Hard-working country fella. And he lived there with his lovely wife, and they raised four boys. They had a boy, the oldest to the youngest, Abner, Marshall, John, and James Jr. And everything was great, right? Had a wonderful life. Kids were grown, the whole deal. And him and his wife are just working away like crazy down there. And everything seems to be good. There was a few that said that some of them were on the outs, that some of the older boys were kind of on the outs with their father. You know how that is. I mean, everybody does every guy here have the best relationship with their father or the best relationship with their grown sons and stuff? It's kind of hard. It's just a thing. It's just a man thing that's hard to explain. You have to work very hard to make it a thing. It's probably a testosterone thing, but let's just say back then, I'm sure it was much the same. So there ends up being a fire. And during that fire, James's house gets just, you know, toasted, gets wrecked out. So he's having it rebuilt. So James and his wife go live with their son, Marshall, and Marshall's married to a woman named Susie. And they go stay there, they put them up while James's house is getting rebuilt, while, you know, Dad's house is getting rebuilt. And so this could be, and I don't know, I can't imagine it being super quick. Like, yeah, we're going to have you out in 2 or 3 weeks. Like, this may have taken months back then, and it's all built by hand. Who knows? We'll just have to see. So that may have been what caused this, not friction, but the exact opposite, the closeness. This may have been what actually brought them together, was them living with their mom and dad, you know, coming to stay with them. And I'm assuming, I couldn't really find it anywhere, but I'm guessing, rather, that Marshall may have lived the closest to his mom and dad at the time, and that was another reason they decided to go there. So everything goes great, right? All that's working along this whole deal. But what ends up happening is, in 1921, after the house is rebuilt, they all go back. Everything's going great, this whole deal. In 1921, James takes a fall. He takes a bad fall doing some work around the place, and it ends up killing him. And so, there it is. Well, what's really strange is, Marshall ends up with the will. And his wife, Susie, is the keeper of all the paperwork. And come to find out, this will was written in 1905. Now, mind you, he died in 1921. And in this will, and it's written, it's brought up, it's brought forward. And the brothers aren't real happy about it. But what it does is it names Marshall the sole benefactor to all of his land, all of his money, his home, all of his belongings. Everything went to Marshall. Which is really odd, because the brothers are like, we all thought we had a pretty good relationship with Dad. This is kind of strange. What happened? Well, even more strange is a year later, Marshall dies. Yeah. From the everlasting faint, folks. Heart problems, heart attack, kills him. So that transfers everything to his wife, Susie. Now, we all know, and some of you have probably experienced, nothing can destroy a family faster than a death. And the last will and testament of something can really, really wreck the foundation a family's built on. And so you can imagine being three brothers, and now your dead brother's wife has all your belongings. Non-blood related, she's got all your goodies. You can only imagine how well that went over, right? And another thing about it was this. None of the brothers had tons of money. So it's not like, well, it didn't matter. Oh, it mattered. They just didn't have tons of cash. This could have worked, right? This could have really helped them out. So you dig into it here. The youngest brother, okay? The youngest brother, James Jr. James Jr. was a penny pincher. This dude was great at being frugal, unbelievably frugal. And he had to grind. He planted like half his crop in sugarcane, and I forgot what else, but he planted all kinds of stuff, but he'd plant them in sections. So he could make more money with this and this. He would always have something growing that he could make money on, instead of it being like maybe one crop a year. These crops alternated, so he was always making money. But he was always doing work, whether it was side work, doing this, doing it. He was always working. And they had their own home, the whole thing. And so the inheritance, if they were to split it, could have brought about more money. Maybe have taken a load off of him. He wouldn't have had to work so hard while he was trying to do all this. But he would never contest the will. He was, you know, he's the baby brother. He's like, well, I guess that's what Dad wanted. And if you were the youngest, of course, you didn't spend as much time with Dad as the older brothers did. So you could kind of understand. I understand my older brothers are older than me. They're more seasoned, whichever, whatever. It's the way it is. It is what it is. So like I said, this is 1921, whenever the father dies and all this goes down. So fast forward until the summer of 25. In 1925, James Jr. starts thinking, man, I don't think this is right. Something's not right about this whole deal. And they're like, well, what do you mean? So he starts telling his wife, he was like, I don't want to sound crazy, but Dad's been coming to me in my dreams the last few times. And in these dreams, he looks very, very sad. He has this look on his face of just disappointment and regret. Of course, I don't know what that looks like. I have no idea. But that's what he looks like. And so he's even quoted in the court records giving a description of what he is witnessing in his dreams, this dream he has. I'll read it for you. This is a quote that they have from the court records saying, I began to have very vivid dreams that my father appeared to me at my bedside, but made no verbal communication. Sometime later, I think it was latter part of June 1925, he appeared at my bedside again, dressed as I had often seen him dressed in life, wearing a black overcoat, which I knew to be his coat. This time my father's spirit spoke to me. He took hold of his overcoat this way and pulled it back and said, "You will find my will in my overcoat pocket," and then disappeared. Now I want you to hold on to that last line. "You will find my will in my overcoat pocket." Remember that part. We're going to come back to that. So he's telling his wife about all this stuff, right? And his wife's like, "Well, then why don't you go tell your brothers about this? If it's in the pocket, doesn't one of your brothers, where's his clothes? Does Susie have his clothes? I mean, surely you can go get something. Go find the coat." So he's like, "Well, that's a really good idea." So he saddles up and he rides over to his brother John's house. It's just a quick ride, 20-mile horseback ride to go find out. So he slides over there. I'm kidding. I don't know if it's horseback. It just sounds better, right? So he runs over there and he's like, "John, don't you still have a bunch of daddy's clothes?" He's like, "Yeah, I got them. I got them stored up in the attic." He's like, "Do you have his black coat?" "Of course I do." "Well, I'll tell you something in a second. Hold on." He goes, "Come with me." So they go up in the attic and he has John find the box, drags the box out, opens it up. And he was like, "I haven't been here," right? Nothing, none of this stuff. He's telling me none of this stuff's happened. This is the story he goes into. He said, "This is the dream I had and I've been having. And I've just now felt confident enough to tell you. But he came to me last night, Daddy did, and this is what he told me to do. So get his coat out." So at this point, his brother John drags the coat out and he says, "Open that pocket lining and see." And they open it up. There's nothing in it. That pocket lining is empty, but it's been resewn and they can see where it's been resewn and they can feel something back in there. So they start cutting and pulling it loose and they tear it apart. And inside there, there's a rolled up little piece of paper and it's tied off, they say, by a string. And they pull it out, and in that, or written on that little piece of paper, says, "Read the 27th chapter of Genesis in my daddy's old Bible." That's all it says. So he's talking about in your grandfather's Bible, you need to go read that. So at this point, Junior's like, "Wait a minute, this is getting crazy. We need to get someone, be it a lawyer, be it a pillar of the community, to go with us to go find that book and look for that Bible." Because I'm sure they're going to have to go to Mama's house to find the Bible, but they're going to have to go find this. But we need to take somebody that's non-blood related, not family, that doesn't have a dog in the fight, so we don't look crazy. And that's exactly what they do. They go into town. They both ride into town. By this time, of course, the other brother, you know, John, he's on. He's like, "Dude, what is happening?" He's like, "I cannot believe this." So they ride into town and they go get a family friend that was an attorney named Thomas Blackwelder. So they go to Blackwelder and they're like, "Hey, you ain't going to believe this." So they get in there in his office. They lay it all out to him and said, "You need to come go with us. This is the dream I've had. This is what we found while we're looking. Y'all know the rest. Let's party," right? So before I go to where they're going for this whole thing, you remember I told you to hang on to something. What I told you to hang on was, "You will find my will in my overcoat pocket." That's not what you found in that overcoat pocket. You found another note, right? Like you're playing National Treasure. Now it's telling you to go someplace else. So right there is the first red flag that I looked into. I'm like, wait a minute. What's going on here? So we're going to get into what's going on here. So John, Jr., and Blackwelder take off over to the Chafin Mama house. They get over there to her. And they said, "Hey, look, this is what we're looking for. We're looking for Granddad's Bible." She's like, "It'll be right over here." So they go to looking and they find it in a bureau there. They get it out of the drawer. It is so old and it's probably been moved and battered and read how many times that it's in a few pieces. It's like in two or three pieces coming apart. So they start going through it and they find Genesis 27. And there's a piece of paper folded up, wedged down in there to look like a little envelope. So they take it out. Take that part out, and inside of it is the last will and testament dated January 16th, 1919. So they're saying that's when it, of course, you got to imagine this stuff happens all the time, right? So you go into it, you open it all up, and this is what Junior reads to everyone there. "After reading the 27th chapter of Genesis, I, James L. Chaffin, do make my last will and testament, and here it is. I want, after giving my body a decent burial, my little property to be equally divided between my four children. If they are living at my death, both personal and real estate divided equally, if not living, then give their share to the children. And if she is living, you all must take care of your mother. Now this is my last will and testament. Witness my hand and seal, James L. Chaffin. Well, of course, Junior lost his mind. He's like, there it is. Here we go. We're rocking and rolling. It's not just maybe he wrote it first of all and gave it and all that stuff and forgot he gave it to Marshall. And after Marshall died, maybe that's how it all went. You know, you're talking about from like at that time, from 1905 to 1921, there's a big gap you can go through, right? And especially from 1905 to 1919, like I said, maybe he totally forgot about it. Forgot what he had written. Either way, they take all this stuff and they take it to probate court. That's time to rock and roll. Also, matter of factly, he's talking about his little property. Even back then, it was 102 acres is what he had that he was going to divide up amongst his children. So they go there and they go into court. And in court, James Jr. has to tell them how he found out about it. He has to stand up and tell everybody in that courtroom, my daddy came to me in a dream, his ghost, he'd been coming and told me where to find it and where to find this note and how to find this will. And the attorney that he brought with him, and of course everybody believed an attorney back then, the attorney, Blackwelder, had to agree. I was with him. He told me the story and we rode together to his mother's house and we found that and this is what it was. So, nearing into the winter of 1925, they go back into it again and a court ruled, well, the court had to first go and dig in to see if they believed that it was real, if that was a real document. And sure enough, it was. Sure enough, they got them all together because they wanted to make sure that it was right, that James Jr. hadn't dreamed this up, right? They go and they get 10 friends, 10 good friends of James Chaffin. And they go and look and they said, that's his signature. We've all done dealings with him for years. That's his signature. He is the man that signed it all. So that's it. They get ready to go into recess, send everybody out. They're like, all right, we're getting ready to rock and roll. We know how this is going to go. Susie, you get nada. And the brothers get everything. Susie's not mentioning the will. Like, you just lost everything you had. Well, Susie, thinking fast on her feet, goes, hey, how about we agree to settle? Let's just drop all this. I'll quit pushing it. Is it being a fake? If you just don't cut me completely out, because I need a little something, right? And just let me wet my beak, right? So I'm sure her lawyer was like, hey, look, man, that's a real one, and they are going to drop everything off of you. You're not getting anything. So she accepted a quarter of the estate, and the rest was for all the brothers. So she kept just a little bit, and that was it. And so the judge rules it official. That's it. It's done. As far as I know, it may be the only time a ghost has ever had his hand in the abilities, you know, of digging out and going, here you go, we found it. It doesn't stop there, though. Like I had said before, it starts looking a little fishy. Things start getting a little funky when you realize the timing of this whole thing. And apparently we're not the only ones, folks, that believe that. There is a paranormal investigator, and she is a writer, also an author. Her name is Mary Roach. So she's going to be doing this, and she wants to write this book. She's digging into all this stuff, and she knows about this story. So she goes and gets a handwriting expert. This is back in 2004. Mary goes and gets, Miss Roach, gets a handwriting expert named Grant Sperry. And so he gets copies of both wills and he sits down and starts going through them. And this is what he come up with. And this is wild. So what they can tell is the first will was written by someone else and yes, signed by James Chaffin, and the second will was written by James Chaffin and signed, forged by somebody else. That's what they take. How is that even a thing? So your very first will, somebody wrote for you. I get that. I completely understand it. You sign it, we're good. But the second will you wrote, you physically wrote that, and then you died before you signed it, and then somebody else forged your signature, or did one of your sons that was left out of this will, who really needed the money and who was upset, completely distraught about this whole thing, but hit it well. Aggravated, mad, wanting to get even, right? Not happy about this whole thing. Did he take the next 3 or 4 years, concoct this idea, and then practice your handwriting? Did he go over and over and over again and again, seeing your handwriting in the family Bible, having letters written, practicing until he could copy your handwriting so good that his handwriting passed for yours, but he didn't nail the signature? Because it's one thing to write a letter in that handwriting, but it's a whole nother thing for your signature to flow. That signature is something that we all do. And we all even change it a little bit from time to time without even realizing it. But it's those subtle changes that are inherent to us. And it's one of those things that people, some are very good at it, some not so much. So could it have been his son simply concocted this story, built this all in, and waited the right amount of time? He knew he couldn't do it right now. You can't do it a month from now. Hell, you can't do it a year from now. But 4 years? 5 years? Why not? Why not let it sit? She's getting remarried. She's not going anywhere. You've got the ace in your pocket. You've got it ready to go. You're just waiting for that timing. And that's what I think might have happened here. I'm not saying that Chaffin maybe didn't come to him in a dream. I'm not saying Junior didn't have anybody come talk to him in a dream. What I'm saying is, maybe Junior had a little bit bigger hand in it than what he was letting on. But I hope y'all enjoyed those wild stories of help from the grave. I enjoyed them. I've got a few more. We'll probably get into that coming up here pretty quick. But for now, I'm going to wrap this thing up. We'll jump on the other side, wrap the show up, and we'll see what Philly thinks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. All right. I hope you enjoyed the stories of all of those three. They're very interesting. Like I said, I think we've covered Miss Zona Shue before, but the stories of the Gray Man and the stories of Mr. James Chaffin, those were two really, really interesting tales that very possibly could have had some sort of, like the Chaffin story. It could be real, or it could have been the son, like we discussed, that was making it all up. But either way, it's fun to believe that there's some kind of help that they can come back and help you. Exactly. And like I said, I've got several more that I'll probably get into here coming up real soon. I'll probably do some more of those. I might even do some more on the Elite Show coming up. I'll try to pump one out maybe even this weekend and see what happens. But anyway, I hope you enjoyed those. Those are just fun. Like you said, it's fun to think about the fact that if you had unfinished business, that there's somebody there, or they themselves are there to help you or help themselves figure these things out. But, there's a lot of movies that's been made, too, about people that have died, and then they come back to try to help find their killer. There you go.
With Swayze.
Remember that? Who doesn't love Patrick Swayze?
I don't know. I'm sure there's people out there that don't, but I mean,
I'm going to tell you something right now. I'm going to go and confess this.
Uh-oh, here we go.
The other night, I broke down and watched it again, and I know how cheesy, corny, crappy it is. Do you remember Patrick Swayze's in a movie with Bill Paxton and with Liam Neeson?
What's the name of it?
Next of Kin.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, I remember where they come down to
Chicago.
Cheesy?
That's dude, a good movie.
How long has it been since you watched that?
Well, it's been a hot minute.
Yeah, dude, it ain't going to hold up so well when you get on there. You're going to be like,
no?
Yeah.
Well, I remember it being good.
Yeah, I remember a lot. I remember Cyborg with Jean-Claude Van Damme being good.
Yeah, that's not so good.
It's all relative to your age and what you're really digging at the time. But yeah, yeah. But so yeah, that's it. I mean, you're very right. It's Ghost. I should have put some Ghost music like from the movie.
Oh, you're talking about like the Righteous Brothers stuff? Isn't that what
not
they're playing?
That part. Isn't that's whenever him and Miss Demi are fixing to get sensual.
I think that's the Righteous Brothers.
It is. Yeah, it's the Righteous Brothers.
Or maybe it's Otis Redding or something.
No, it's the Righteous Brothers.
Okay.
Yeah, for real.
It's been a long time since I've seen that.
I've got that CD.
There's no,
not the Ghost CD, the CD of the Righteous Brothers, dude, man.
The Righteous Brothers are righteous, legitimately. Yeah. They are good singers. But they don't get enough credit. I'm serious.
What about the Righteous Gemstones? Those guys are jam up, too.
Yeah, that's good, too. Yeah, no, they are legitimate singers. I'm like, you listen to that with all the soul and stuff.
I like those guys.
I mean, I'll confess, when I was younger and I heard the Righteous Brothers, I didn't know those two guys were white.
No, me either.
Not until I saw a video, dude, and I was like, huh, I never knew that.
Now that we're confessing, not only did I not know those guys were white, when I first saw the video, I thought somebody would made it to where, like, they're lip syncing it or something. I'm like, dude, that ain't real.
That's one of my favorite things about music is like, for what, like, say a really British sounding person, but when they sing, it doesn't sound like it. Like, I don't know how many times, like, or it doesn't even have to be somebody from a different country. You ever hear a song like on the radio and you really like it, then you go look and you see the person that's it, you're like, what?
He doesn't sound like
that.
Don't
look right.
Yeah.
That does not look like what she sounds like or he sounds like. That's one of my favorite things. Or even somebody really good at like an instrument.
Oh,
and then you see him, you're like, that's what they look like?
I don't know. And why do we build those misconceptions in our head? I don't understand.
I don't know. And sometimes it ruins it for me because like then it's like not what I was picturing in my mind.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
You got to pick one or the other. Would you rather be a really awesome guitar player or a really awesome singer? You can't be both.
Probably singer because I don't need an instrument. I can do it anywhere, right? Where an instrument, I could break a string.
Yeah.
Have to carry it, lug it around with me. I'm already lugging my vocal cords around, brother.
I'm the same way. I would love to be able to sing.
Yeah. There's a lot of things. If we're going to make a list on the things I'd love to do.
But I mean, singing is one of those that's always been at the top of my list.
It's one of those things.
I love it.
I know you can train and get better, but it is kind of like one of those things like you're either born with it or you're not. Am I crazy for feeling that way?
What's the documentary we watched that you took me to watch, 12 Foot from Stardom?
I don't remember.
Wasn't that the backup singers? That's the one? Yeah.
I don't remember the name of it, but that, yeah, it was amazing.
That is a great film. A great film. Yeah, folks, hope you enjoyed all that. We're not going to keep you around here dragging this stuff around, talking about me and Kyle's wishes. We got to get out of here.
Did you finish your construction on the bathrooms?
No, it got sidelined. And when I say sidelined, I mean another construction job popped up and I had to do it. So now I've had to completely redo my daughter's room. So in between bathrooms, I tore out my daughter's room, repainted and put all new flooring and built a new bed to go in there.
I've been sending Cam like Bob Vila memes and stuff. Yeah, and for you non-elite members, if you've been wondering why the delay in shows, our major editing computer, the Mac that I used to edit all the shows, it completely crashed, and I've been spending 3 to 4 days. I took it to 2 different places to finally get it going, and it's not 100% now. I lost a lot of the sound effects and stuff I've accumulated over the years. That's depressing. I think I can go back and go to those websites and manually re-download them because we've already purchased them, but that's been what's going on. And with work and you're remodeling and the computer's failing, I was like,
it's 2020.
It's 2020.
100%. It's 2020.
100% 2020.
Yep,
all right,
that's
folks.
How it works.
Well, if you have any stories you'd like to share with me and Cam, I'm going to make up. This is a little bit different. And I realize because I'm getting a lot of emails from people wanting to know that they have a story and do we want you to share them? So it's not y'all's fault. Y'all were doing what I asked. It's completely my fault. Once again, it's on me. If you have a story you would like to share with me and Cam, share or email us your story at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. See, I was saying email the show, not email your story to the show.
Yeah. And here's another thing. At the end of that story, when you put it all together as best you possibly can, give us your phone number where we can contact you. If it's something that we really, really dig, and we really dig a lot of stuff, as y'all know, we will call you and have you retell it. If not, if it's something that's like a short and sweet one, then we'll just toss it in like we do with the rest of the news and stuff like that. If it's something that's an intricate deal, that like maybe it's too much, but you're going to have to give us a flavor of it first so we can see as we can go through it, we'll try to set up a time to holler at you about it.
Absolutely, yeah. And if you are going to write it out, I mean, be as thorough as you can.
Yes,
I mean,
please.
Please. I mean, we don't want one paragraph stories. We like them longer, if possible.
And if you got real scary pictures, I don't want to see them. I'll lose them. So you got to send those to Kyle.
All right, folks. You can follow us on all forms of social media. Till next time, folks, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.